Thanks for joining us. I'm Jonathan Smith, and you're listening to the Maine Public Broadcasting Network. Buying a car, for some, it's a thrilling experience, a chance to express a little bit of ourselves in what we drive. For others, the thought of haggling over the cost of a car, let alone figuring out which model or options are best, can be overwhelming. With me in the studio is Jamie Page Deaton, editor of U.S. News & World Report's Best Car Rankings. Today, we'll be talking about how to get the best deal on a new car, why December is a good month to buy a new car or truck, and the latest news from the automotive industry, including whether Japanese automakers have recovered from the devastating earthquake and tsunami that struck their country in March. We'll also talk about why Dodge is bringing back the Dart. Jamie Page Deaton, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. So let's start with the latest news on the Chevy Volt. From what I've seen, there's some issues with the battery, maybe the car catching on fire. What's going on here? What's the problem?
Yeah, this is one of those sort of car stories that seems tailor-made for the media, because what's happened is the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration crash-tested the Volt. And then a couple days later, the Volt caught fire.
Not good.
And of course, you know, the Volt is a halo car for General Motors. It's what they call their moonshot car. There's a lot of consumer interest in this car. And so, of course, the media's taken it and sort of ran with it because there's a lot of interest in it. Now, I do want to make it clear that though, you know, NHTSA's investigated this and GM's reacting to this, the Volt, from what the tests show, is not the Ford Pinto of the new millennium. It's not like you're going to be in a crash in your Volt and then it's going to suddenly burst into flames. What happened is in the crash, which was simulating a rollover crash, is the Volt's battery pack was punctured and then some coolant leaked out, causing a short circuit. And that's what caused the fire. This actually happened several days after the crash.
So has this happened in real life, or this is just one incident?
No, this has only happened in very specific crash tests. There are no reports of this happening actually out in the real world. And trust me, if it had, we'd know about it.
Okay. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You could shoot us an email to talk@mpbn.net or post a comment or question on our Facebook page, and we'll get to those in just a little bit. But back to the Volt. So how is the Volt selling? Is it reaching the expectations Chevy has for it?
Chevy was hoping to sell 10,000 Volts this year, and they are falling well short of that goal. In fact, last month they told dealers it was okay to sell their demo stock, which effectively doubled the number of Volts that were available for sale, and they are still not reaching their sales goals.
And is it a question of marketing? Is it a question of the car? I mean, are hybrids doing okay, or are they...
Overall, hybrids are doing well, especially, you know, when gas prices go up, hybrids go up. Gas prices now are trending down, so hybrid sales are trending down. What I think the main issue with the Volt is that it's expensive.
How much is it?
This is a car. It starts at over $40,000. You get a tax credit, which brings it down into the 30s, but that's really out of reach for most people, even if you're trying to save a lot of money on gas. The other thing that was sort of holding the Volt back is when it initially launched, it wasn't available in all areas of the United States. They sort of rolled it out. So somebody who was really interested in it maybe couldn't have gotten it right away. And of course, now that there are reports of fires and things like that, people can start saying, huh, maybe I don't want a Volt. Maybe the Prius is looking pretty good.
Now, how do hybrids do? I've heard there can be issues in cold climates. Or has that been addressed? Is that an issue?
I've heard, and I know this is, you know, probably of great concern to the listeners here, you know, in Maine, because it gets awfully cold. But you've got to realize that when automakers develop a car, they put it through very extreme testing. And I haven't seen any issues or heard of any issues with, say, hybrid batteries in colder weather. Now, what you might want to do is make sure that, you know, if you have a hybrid or considering a hybrid, you might want to, you know, keep it in a garage if possible. But their batteries are so much bigger and so much different than your typical conventional car battery. That some of the issues with cold weather you just don't see.
Now, speaking of the bigger batteries, most hybrid, I think of a hybrid, I think of, you know, small little Prius. And the Volt, you know, it's a mid-size car.
Mm-hmm.
Are companies developing sort of big hybrids, or even like a pickup size hybrid?
Oh, yeah. There's the Chevy Silverado hybrid is on the market, and then there's the GMC Sierra hybrid, which is on the market. You can also get a Cadillac Escalade hybrid, which is more bling than green. But, you know.
What kind of mileage difference are we talking about with these
trucks? We're talking about, with those, about a 25% increase in gas mileage overall. You do better when you're in the city, obviously. And the thing that sort of holds back these hybrids in terms of sales is that they cost a lot more than their gas-only counterparts. I think the Cadillac Escalade hybrid starts above $10,000 more than the conventional hybrid, which, when you do the math, you're not going to pay off in terms of fuel savings. But if you have, for example, a lot of kids, you do a lot of city driving, that hybrid could actually make sense because rather than having to take two cars, which would spew a lot of carbon into the air, you can just take one. And so it makes a little bit of sense there. But a lot of these larger hybrids, for the time being, are really just about sort of flashing your green cred.
Not really work else. Trucks more so than...
Yeah. And some of the hybrids, like the hybrid Silverado and the hybrid Sierra, there is a compromise in terms of things like towing capacity. It's not a huge compromise. I think for most... if you're just going to Home Depot, if you're just doing a lot of gardening, something like that, if you're just sort of a private truck user, you'd be fine with a hybrid truck. But if you're really looking for a heavy-duty work truck, then a hybrid's probably not the best
choice.
Not yet.
But if Chevy and Toyota working on one, is that...
They are working on one, which would hopefully beef up the hybrid capabilities of the Chevy Silverado hybrid. But that's, in the pipeline, it's a couple years away.
Okay. Well, let's move on from these high-tech cars to an old classic. It's about to become new again. The Dodge Dart. Tell me about
Dart.
This. I think my mother had a Dodge Dart back in the 70s. That thing was a tank.
Well, yeah. I mean, the Dart sort of had a bad reputation as sort of a grandma car. Now Dodge is bringing it back.
With help from Fiat,
It's actually going to be based on, I think, an Alfa Romeo, which is a very small compact car. Dodge has released some teaser photos of it. They're very tightly cropped pictures of
How's
the bumper.
It
looks pretty good to me. I mean, I love the way Alfas look. Dodge is being very clear that this is not a... just going to be a rebadged Alfa Romeo. It's going to be specific for the Dodge lineup. But that said, it's going to come over. It's going to be a compact car. Hopefully, because it's an Alfa Romeo, which are known throughout Europe for being very sporty, very fun to drive. I don't know if you watch Top Gear. The guys on Top Gear from the BBC just love Alfas because they are so much fun to drive. And so hopefully that translates over with, maybe some more American-friendly features, wider seats, good gas mileage, things like that.
And when will that hit the showrooms?
That's going to debut at the Detroit Auto Show in January, and then hopefully it'll hit showrooms sometime within the next year.
Huh, neat. Well, we'll have to look forward to that. You're listening to the Maine Public Broadcasting Network. I'm Jonathan Smith. With me in the studio is Jamie Page Deaton. She's editor of U.S. News and World Report's Best Car Rankings. We're talking cars. Join the conversation. Give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You can also send us an email, talk@mpbn.net, or leave a comment or question on our Facebook page. You just mentioned the auto show. We just had the LA Auto Show. We've got what I think of as the Detroit Auto Show, but its official title is the
North American International Auto Show.
Starting in a couple weeks, January.
Yeah, just a couple weeks.
What did you see in LA, or what did you hear about in LA, and what are you looking forward to?
Well, the big story that's going to be, I think, for all auto shows this year, it's sort of the resurgence of the compact car. This started building last year. And what we've really seen in sales trends is a move away from the giant SUVs that I think have dominated the past couple years. And we're moving more towards smaller cars. Detroit Cadillac will be debuting a new compact car, which is specifically, it's compact for a Cadillac.
It's not the Cimarron or again.
No. It's not the Cimarron and it's not the Caddy that zigs, although they're putting it forward as a BMW 3 Series fighter. And considering how well the CTS has done and how much fun the CTS is, it'll really be interesting to see how this new compact Cadillac does. GM's also debuting a new Buick compact SUV, which makes a lot of sense because they have a platform that goes across their Chevy brand, their GMC brand, and their Cadillac brand, and they don't have a smaller one for Buick. The Buick Enclave, which is a midsize SUV, is one of their best sellers, so going into a compact SUV class makes a lot of sense.
Neat. Any trends? I mean, so we've got compact cars, we've talked hybrids. Anything else out there that's jumped out at you?
The big trend with compact cars is that they're no longer just the car you have to buy because you can't afford anything better. They're becoming very what's known in the industry as heavily contented, which basically just means they got a lot of fun stuff in them. you can get things like Bluetooth standard on a lot of compact cars. You can get satellite radio. You get iPod integration. You get navigation. The things that you would expect from a luxury car are now available in smaller packages, which is great because you can save on gas.
And now your publication has done some rankings of 2011 cars.
2012.
2012,
yep.
Which is really 2011. What'd you discover? Which ones are highest ranking?
Well, this is what's really interesting. We've been doing these rankings for five years now. We're going on 5 years now. And it used to be our rankings were dominated by Honda and Toyota. That's no longer the case. There are very few classes where the top five are taken up by Honda and Toyota models. Now what you see, particularly since we've talked about small cars, you see the Honda Fit does well, but it's surpassed by cars like the Hyundai Accent, the Hyundai Veloster, the Kia Forte, the Ford Focus.
What about the Chevy Cruze?
The Chevy Cruze is another great example, the Chevy Spark. And these other companies are coming in and sort of beating Honda and Toyota at their own game, which is offering a lot of quality and value for the price.
Does this have anything to do at all with the tsunami and the earthquake? I mean, are they fully recovered back to production levels before that disaster hit?
Yeah, actually, most Japanese car companies are back to full production. But even though car sales overall are doing really well, the Japanese companies have been left behind a little bit. And what this gets back to is that companies like Hyundai and Kia are offering similar cars for less money and more standard features. And within our rankings are based on the collective opinion of the automotive press. We take and we analyze all the credible published reviews of a given car, and we bake that into a scoring algorithm. And so what our rankings show is that car reviewers are starting to prefer these cars from other companies, simply because Honda and Toyota haven't stepped up and added the features that people really want to see at the price that they want to pay for them.
Do you see that changing soon? I think I saw that the head of Honda Motors sort of acknowledges they've had some issues with maybe their hybrid car, the hybrid Civic.
Yeah. The hybrid Civic was a real big surprise, and actually the Civic in general, because it was redesigned for 2012. And I actually had it out as a test car a couple of weeks ago. And my mother actually drives a 2007 Honda Civic. So I got into the 2012 Honda Civic. Could barely tell the difference between the 2007 and the 2012. That isn't good. And it was a fine car. I mean, it drove fine. It was just, it was sort of white bread. But when you compare it to other hybrids that I've driven recently, you know, like a Kia Optima hybrid and even other just compact cars that I've driven recently, the Civic just really didn't measure up. It wasn't that it was a bad car. It was just that these other cars were a lot better. And so the press really lambasted the 2012 Civic. In our rankings, it used to always be in the top five. I think it's now number 23 out of 26 in affordable small cars, which is a huge drop. And I think Honda's smart to say, wow, you know, we sort of came over to America and we beat the big three at their own game. And now the Korean companies, you know, Hyundai's coming over and beating us at our own game.
Now, does Hyundai have a hybrid in the works or one out there now that
you can get? They have the Hyundai Sonata hybrid. And then Hyundai's other brand is Kia. And there's a Kia Optima hybrid. Both are sort of, they're midsize sedans, but they're large for midsize sedans. Both offer good gas mileage. And again, the thing that Hyundai and Kia are known for are a lot of features for the money. So if you get, you know, I had a test Kia Optima hybrid. It cost $32,000 was the sticker price on it. It had every single possible feature that I could think of on a new car, short of massaging seats. But like,
and how many cars come with that these days?
I think only a couple Bentleys do.
Okay.
But you could get things like heated seats in the back.
Wow.
Which is nice, especially up here in New England. Your backseat passengers will appreciate that. And it got pretty good fuel economy, too.
Oh, that's pretty neat. Let's go to the phones. We've got a call from Frederick in South Portland. Frederick, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. Hey, it's just wonderful to hear a program on hybrid technology. Where else but on public radio, right?
There you go. Do you have a question for Jamie?
Yeah, well, you know, I just wanted to say, years ago, back in the 90s, I caught word of the hybrid technology. I guess it was through the Sierra Club. So when I found that, you know, the technology was out, I ran over to our local dealer in South Portland and ultimately ended up buying what I think is the first hybrid car that was sold. It was certainly the first hybrid called Toyota Prius sold by this local dealer. And that car now has nearly 180,000 miles, and it has just been a gem for us. The other Toyota Prius that we had purchased in our family has 160,000 miles. So we're working on 340,000 miles of Toyota Prius, and I tell you, it has just done beautifully here in the Maine winter. And we've taken the car cross country on a couple of occasions, and I just have the utmost respect and admiration for this Prius, and the new evolution of the Prius to me has been interesting to see. And I wanted to ask your guest if she would comment on how her view of the evolution of the Prius has gone, and is it still a sticker price that's really pretty reasonable when you're looking at a car with this technology? I believe it would be probably around $25,000, is that right?
Yeah, that's about right for the price. And the thing that Toyota has done just for this year that's really smart with the Prius is they're expanding the whole brand. So you have your Prius, which, you know, the one you bought, I think the first one was actually a sedan, and then they changed it to a hatchback sort of shape. And they still have that one, the original Prius, but they've added the Prius C, which is a little Prius coupe, which is aimed at, you know, what we call DINKs, you know, dual income, no kids couples. And then also the Prius V, which is basically a Prius station wagon, which has as much cargo space as a small SUV. Because what people kept saying is, gee, I want a hybrid, but I just need more space for my lifestyle. So I think that's smart. And I think, you know, just like the caller was saying, the Prius has been great for Toyota. It's the icon of hybrid cars, and now other companies are starting to really get on the bandwagon with it.
Frederick, thank you so much for your call. You're listening to the Maine Public Broadcasting Network. I'm Jonathan Smith. With me in the studio is Jamie Page Deaton, editor of U.S. News and World Report's Best Car Rankings. We're going to take a quick break right now, but when we come back, we'll answer more of your questions. Send us an email, talk@mpbn.net. Post a comment to our Facebook page or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566.
After the Second World War, American diplomat George Kennan designed a strategy of containment to check Soviet ambitions. The imperfect implementation of his plan and its legacy.
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show this afternoon at 2 o'clock.
Hey, it's us, Click and Clack from Car Talk. What are you going to do with your old car when you buy a new one?
Oh, you could trade it in.
Yeah, and get 50 cents and a free set of floor mats. Or you could donate it to this station and get a nice, fat tax deduction.
I like that.
Find out more at 866-789-TMCP.
TMCP?
Take my car, please.
That's 866-789-8627.
For more information, visit mpbn.net and click on radio or support.
Welcome back. This is MPBN. I'm Jonathan Smith. Today on the program, the latest news out of Detroit, Japan, Germany, and anywhere else where they make cars. Join the conversation by giving us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Send us an email, talk@mpbn.net, or post a comment or question on our Facebook page. With me in the studio, Jamie Page Deaton, editor of U.S. News and World Report's Best Car Rankings. We're in December. Is this a good month to buy a car?
December is an excellent month to buy
a car.
How so? Well, there's a company called TrueCar, and what they do is they track real-time transaction prices from dealers. And what they do from this data is say, all right, historically speaking, what are the best days to buy a car? When are people getting the biggest discounts? And it turns out that 7 of the 10 best days to buy a car are in December.
Wow. Now, is it true? I've heard that you should always wait to the end of the month to buy a car. That's when you get the absolute best deal. Is that true, or is that sort of urban legend?
Well, it certainly doesn't hurt. Towards the end of the month, you know, there's this idea that dealers are trying to make their quota. I think car buying has changed a little bit, though, in that thanks to the internet, you know, everybody has the same information that the car dealer has, so it makes it a lot easier to negotiate a good price.
All right. Let's take another call now. We've got Peter from York who's been waiting patiently. Peter, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Do you have a comment or question for Jamie?
Yeah, it's a comment. There's a large movement around the world on do-it-yourself cars, and a lot of them are around the motorcycle concept with three wheels because of the legal implications. And in Maine, we have several people that are working on their own cars, and one famous one is the Moonbeam. It's been around for over 5 years. It's gone over 15,000 miles, and it gets 105 miles per gallon. And it costs less than $6,000 for the gentleman to build. And it's on the internet if you Google Moonbeam. They also did an X car, and they weren't able to get enough funding to get it done in time, but that one has won the race from the East Coast to the West Coast, and it's a three-cylinder, two-place diesel. And it has much greater performance and higher speed than the Moonbeam. The Moonbeam goes around town, but the three-cylinder diesel one gets around 90 miles per gallon. So it's, the benchmark has been set by the do-it-yourselfers, and the high-priced cars coming from Detroit and other countries, et cetera, are really aimed at the general public that don't know how to build their own. But the Shell Eco Marathon, I believe the record is over 10,000 miles per gallon, but those are specialized one-person college-type creations. So there is a large range between what may be possible in the future and what is coming out of the mass production market at the moment.
Peter, thank you so much for your call. Jamie, are you familiar with that vehicle?
That's actually, Peter made some great points. The do-it-yourself market, there are all sorts of things you can do with cars. You can... There's every year there's a symposium on how to convert any car into a hybrid car, any car into an electric car. And it really is a great movement. I love the do-it-yourself cars because you can find cars that are powered by wood, which I think is really neat.
It's interesting. We got an email from Chris Kay who wrote, a few folks in Maine use oil from restaurants as fuel. UMaine is working on fuel from wood. Some of the big oil companies have invested in biofuels from algae and other raw material. What's the auto industry's take on the future of all this? Are we seeing more of this?
Here's where you sort of reach the crutch. You know, as Peter was mentioning, most of these very high mileage do-it-yourself cars are three wheels. They're technically motorcycles. And if you're just building a car yourself, you're not subject to the same regulations as Chevy is subject to when they're building a car. You don't have to worry about hitting safety regulations, which is a huge thing. And you also don't have to worry about selling that car, which Chevy has to worry about. I mean, try and sell, you know, a three-wheeled car that only seats one or two people to a family. It's just not going to work. And so what really happens is consumers and the general public demand certain things from their cars that these DIY cars are not just going to be able to hit. When you're talking about the various fuels that are under development, the fuel from wood, I think what you're referring to is actually, you know, it's just like ethanol. It's a fuel from corn that they build that they make out in the Midwest. It's just, you know, over here in Maine, there's a lot more wood than there is corn. So why not use leftover wood products to make fuel? The problem with things like developing fuel from ethanol or looking at even, you know, diesel or cooking oil diesel, which you can run any diesel engine if you convert cooking oil into biodiesel. It's great. Your car will smell like French fries as you go down the road.
That's an added plus.
But the thing is, what sort of holds back the development of these alternative fuels is infrastructure. If you go ahead and you have a diesel car and you go in your basement, you make your own batch of biodiesel, you fill it up, you hit the road. What are you going to do when you run out?
Sort of the same thing with hydrogen-powered cars. It's sort of a chicken or the egg. I think the car companies say when the hydrogen infrastructure is in place, they'll build them. And the hydrogen manufacturers say once the cars are there, we'll build that. So we've got Peter on the line from Farmington who has a question about hybrid diesels. Before we get to him, I want to mention an email from John P., who writes in, whether your money is tight because of the economy or evading ensuing zombie hordes, and we'll get to the zombies in a little bit, which vehicles can the average person still work on? And I tend to think of like a diesel car, sort of a more simple engine, and I know cars are so high tech now. So before we get to Peter's call, any cars that sort of friendly for these do-it-yourselfers to work on?
Not new cars, no.
And none at all. I mean, not even the diesels?
The diesels are a little bit more friendly just because of but what it comes down to is automakers, even with the diesels, the new diesels, you know, if you buy one that's just a couple years old, then you might be able to do more on it. But automakers are really working on squeezing the most possible gas out of every mile the car drives. They're doing that mainly through software, not through mechanical.
Huh. Interesting. Let's go to Peter. Peter, thank you for joining us. Do you have a question for Jamie?
Yes, please.
Go ahead.
I'm curious if this follows up on some of your conversation already. Are there any manufacturers that are working on hybrid diesels? And if so, who are they and what are your expectations coming to market on any of those types of products?
Peter, thanks for your question.
Thanks. That is a really good question. And it's one that I know a lot of people have a lot of interest in because diesels are big in Europe. Hybrids are big here. Why not combine the two?
Exactly.
Right now, I don't know of anybody who's working on a hybrid diesel in the United States. They're just different requirements that a diesel motor takes and that a gas electric or that an electric components would work with it. And so it just makes it a little bit more complicated. That doesn't mean that automakers aren't working on it. That just means they aren't talking about it yet, which is a big distinction to make.
Thank you again, Peter, for your call. I've got an email from Susan S. who asks, what are the best high-mileage cars for really tall people? I think this might hit home for you a little bit. That's her first question. Her second question is, have they tested any of these vehicles in deer or moose collisions? Big issue up here. Third question, if zombies do in fact learn to drive, are we doomed? So let's start with the zombie question first. Why are we talking zombies?
We're talking zombies. Well, first, let me just go ahead and answer the question. I think most people drive like zombies now anyway. So we're already pretty much as bad as it can get. What Susan's referring to is an article that I wrote about the five best cars for outrunning zombie hordes, which, of course, this was for Halloween. It wasn't just worried about it. But, you know, Maine, it's a Stephen King state. You never know what you might run into. So I think it's important to think, all right, will this car help me escape zombie hordes or, you know, killer fogs or other monsters that come crawling out of the woods. Now, Susan, your first question about the best high-mileage cars for really tall people. At first, I was like, well, geez, I'm not exactly the best person to answer this because I'm only 5'3". But my husband is 6'1", and I used to work with a guy who was 6'7". And so I talked a little bit about what cars they liked. A couple of weeks ago, I had the Fiat 500 out at the house.
It's a little car.
It's a very small car, but it gets good gas mileage. At first, I thought, oh, this will be great because it seems so tall on the inside to me. My husband gets in the passenger seat, promptly hits his head on the roof. And that was because the driver's seat could be raised and lowered, the passenger seat could not. So he basically had to ride around reclined the whole time. My brother-in-law is 6'1". He and his wife actually had a Honda Fit. Now, you think about these small cars, you think, oh, there's not that much headroom inside. But what you forget about, compared to an SUV, is that smaller cars have a lower seating position. SUVs tend to have a very high chair-like seating position. So you can actually have a deceptive amount of headroom in a smaller car. So the Honda Fit is a good one for taller people. My former colleague, who was 6'7", fit very comfortably into a Volkswagen Golf. Not so comfortably into a Mazda Miata. He said his head would stick up above the windshield there. But the Volkswagen Golf is a good one because it's available as a diesel, which is very good high mileage. You can get it in two or four doors. When you get it in four doors, you can actually fit things like a car seat in the back seat, although you probably don't want to put it behind your 6'4 driver or 6'4 passenger. And then your other question about have they tested any new vehicles in deer and moose collisions? No. Is the basic answer. I think that would be a YouTube sensation if they did. But
imagine.
I started thinking through this question about, all right, how would you then know how well a car would do in a deer-moose collision? And I would really look at, since these cars are smaller, they are closer to the ground. When you are looking at a moose collision, moose are very, very tall. In a small car, you're going to be taking the moose out basically at the knees, so which means he's probably going to fall onto the roof of your car. And so the roof strength tests are really what I would look at if you're worried about those types of collisions. Because the roof strength tests, and the best ones, I think, are done by the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. You can check them out at IIHS.org. And they basically they test the car to make sure that the roof can withstand four times the car's weight on the roof for a certain period of time, which is four times the weight of a Honda Fit is more than a typical moose is going to wear.
And that website again, IHS?
IIHS.org.
You're listening to the Maine Public Broadcasting Network. I'm Jonathan Smith. With me in the studio is Jamie Page Deaton, auto editor for U.S. News and World Reports. Car rankings, sorry if I got that wrong. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Join the conversation. That's 1-800-399-3566. Send us an email, talk@mpbn.net, or leave a comment or question on our Facebook page. We're going to go to Ned now in Bar Harbor, who has a question about size of a different matter, 8-passenger cars. Ned, thank you for giving us a call.
Hi.
Go ahead.
We have a large family, 6 children. We have a Toyota Sienna right now, which seats 7. So if we're all traveling together, we can't fit. We have to take 2 cars. We recently rented a 2012 Sienna that seats 8, but for some reason they don't seem to offer that in an all-wheel drive model. The 8-passenger is only available as a front-wheel drive. The 7-passenger is available as an all-wheel drive. And I'm wondering if you know why.
I have no idea why. That seems to be a really interesting question. Because as soon as you said 8, I was thinking Sienna.
They're the only minivan that, or Chrysler makes an all-wheel, don't they?
No. So the Toyota Sienna is the only minivan that makes all-wheel drive.
Huh.
And so if you're really looking for an all-wheel drive car that seats 8 and Toyota's not offering that extra bench, which basically what they do is they replace the 2 captain's chairs in the second row of the minivan with a bench seat, you're going to need to look at a large SUV with all-wheel drive. And that means you're going to be getting up into things like the Chevy Tahoe, the Lincoln Navigator, and those types of cars because basically, if you want all-wheel drive, and it's something that I've sort of noticed, these large families that live up north where you really need all-wheel drive, they sort of get left out in the cold and are almost forced into large SUVs. And these large SUVs are true SUVs. They're not a crossover at all. But that's if you need seating for eight and you need all-wheel drive, and then those are what you're going to have to look at. I'm really surprised that the Sienna is not offer with all-wheel drive and a bench. I'm going to actually make a note to contact Toyota and see why that is.
And you'll post what you find to our Facebook page.
What I find to Facebook, because it might just be a demand issue. You know, it might just not be cost-effective for them to have that particular configuration, because there just aren't that many people who are asking for it. But, you know, I'll certainly see what they say.
Great. Ned, thank you so much for your call. We're going to take another short break right now. When we return, more of your comments and questions for Jamie Page Deaton, auto expert extraordinaire. Please stay tuned. This is the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.
On the next Fresh Air, now that Newt Gingrich is having an unexpected surge in the polls, we talk with Karen Tumulty, who's covered him for years. She's a national political correspondent for The Washington Post. We'll look at his political career and how he became a wealthy man after he left Congress by what she describes as playing the Washington system in an entrepreneurial way. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock.
The number of people with eating disorders such as anorexia and bulimia is higher now than ever before. In Maine, there is a new network of professional teams aimed at early intervention. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This week on Maine Watch, we'll learn about this program and some of the latest thinking about eating disorders. Plus, we'll discuss a new report looking at mercury contamination in Maine rivers.
That's Maine Watch tonight at 8 and tomorrow at 9 on MPBN television, or Friday afternoon at 12:30. Here on MPBN Radio.
Welcome back. This is Jonathan Smith. You're listening to a new program on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, and we're asking you to help us come up with a name for this show. Send me your suggestions. My email is jpsmith@mpbn.net. That's jpsmith@mpbn.net, or post them to our Facebook page. Today, a conversation about cars. Are you thinking about buying a new car? What's the most important to you? Safety, mileage, price? Give us a call. 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Or send us an email or post a comment or question on our Facebook page. We're going to go back to the phones now. We're going to go to Chris in Scarborough. Chris, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Great. Do you have a question for Jamie?
Yes. You had a previous caller that mentioned the Prius, and I had a chance to drive one some years ago. And the one thing that I noticed about it that I liked so much was the instrumentation of the dashboard. At the bottom of the windshield, there's a little slot that gives you all your basic information, your speed, your fuel, the stuff you need to know regularly. And traveling a fair amount, renting a lot of different cars, I never get into a car, and I'm an average height, where the steering wheel isn't right in the middle of the dashboard. We have to look around the steering wheel to see how fast you're going or whether you need gas or not. We've heard a lot about changes in instrumentation and maybe even heads-up displays right on the windshield. Does she see any of that coming down the road?
Yes. Actually, there are a number of cars on the market that actually have heads-up display available now, and I think it's a great innovation. It's actually not that much of an innovation. Basically, what they do is they have a digital display that they reflect upon the windshield with a mirror. Now, you mentioned specifically you like the instrumentation in the Prius, so the cars with heads-up display are probably going to disappoint you a little bit. The Chevrolet Camaro SS has available heads-up display, which is not exactly a high-mileage green car. The Chevy Corvette also has heads-up display. There are rumors that this year's, the 2012 BMW 3 Series, will also have available heads-up display. And just for the viewers that don't know, you know, or listeners that don't know, heads-up display is where your speed is and other key information is projected onto the windshield, and you can look through it. It's basically the same technology that fighter pilots have in their planes, which makes it super cool because as you're zipping along, you do feel like a fighter pilot. And personally, I think it's a great safety feature because you're not looking down all the time. But it does tend to be, because it's sort of a gee whiz kind of performance feature, it does tend to be focused and available mainly in sports cars and other performance cars.
Not something I'm going to be looking for in the car I'm looking at.
Well, hopefully they'll come to the other car soon. Chris, thanks so much for your call. We've got an email from Anita asking, is there an all-wheel drive hybrid yet? The Highlander.
Yeah,
right?
There's a Toyota Highlander hybrid, and then you can also get the Ford Escape hybrid, which is going to be redesigned, so it'll be brand new. And the Ford Escape hybrid was really due for a redesign because, remember, it came out during the Clinton administration.
Right.
It hasn't changed since. So, yes, you can get an all-wheel drive hybrid. Just know that all-wheel drive with any car adds a lot of weight. Anytime you add weight, you're going to decrease fuel economy. So you won't get as good mileage as you would if you got a two-wheel drive hybrid, but it's a really nice compromise if you really need all-wheel drive.
Lots of questions. Another email about mileage. Can you touch on diesel vehicles in the U.S. and why they are still shunned? This is from David. He believes approximately 70% of BMWs sold in Europe are diesel.
Yeah.
Any sense on that?
My sense of why diesels are shuns, it's just consumers have bad memories of diesels. And BMW has actually started addressing this in their marketing campaigns. They have a new marketing campaign out for the Diesel X6, which is it's a sort of coupe-like sporty SUV. And it shows people in sort of old diesels. There's a family in an old Volvo station wagon that's just belching black smoke, and the engine's knocking, and they're going slowly uphill. And the reason is, you know, most Americans remember diesels as being these horrible cars that were slow and dirty and loud. The diesels that are available now simply aren't like that. And so automakers are having a little bit of trouble getting the word out. You know, again, you know, to go back to BMW diesels, during Cash for Clunkers, BMW had released its 335D, which was a 3-series diesel. Auto reviewers just loved it. It was eligible for Cash for Clunkers, which meant that the government would give you $4,500 if you turned in, you know, an old gas guzzler for it. And then BMW was matching that with $4,500.
Wow.
So you were getting $9,000 off this car.
I know what I want for Christmas.
And people were not buying it.
Huh.
So it really is just consumer perception. If you want diesels to catch on in this country, buy a diesel, talk it up. That's going to be the best way.
Great. All right, let's go to Mark now. Mark, can you tell me, where are you calling us from?
I'm on I-95 right now.
Oh, good. I hope you're pulled over and practicing safe driving.
I am pulled over.
Great. Do you have a question for Jamie?
Well, excuse me. Yeah, years ago, I mean, many years ago, I used to drive an old VW Beetle, a 75 Beetle, and then an older Toyota Tercel. And these cars just, I mean, regularly got 32 to 35 miles to the gallon. And, of course, this was many years ago. And now I'm driving a Scion XA, a 2005. And, you know, it gets about 33 miles to the gallon. And we looked really hard to find a small car that got better than 33 miles a gallon. We just can't. I mean, here we're 20-some years later. And, you know, I'm driving a car with all this new technology, and it gets as good gas mileage as my old 75 Beetle did. You know, what? Why can't we find cars that get better?
Well, actually, the answer is just right in what you said. You said, I'm driving this car with all this new technology. Well, guess what? That new technology weighs a lot. All cars now are required to have electronic stability control. Most of them have things like traction control. And then again, you know, I mentioned having heavily contented small cars where you have all the electronics. That takes a toll on mileage, again, because it just adds weight. Now, I will say, though, that there are a number of small cars on the market now that get better than 40 miles per gallon with regular gasoline engines. The brand new Mazda 3 with the SkyActiv technology. This is a gasoline engine. In Japan, this model actually gets 75 miles per gallon. Here, it gets up to 42 miles per gallon.
Why the difference? Pollution controls?
Just different controls, different regulations from country to country. You can get a Ford Fiesta that gets excellent gas, that gets above 40 miles per gallon. You can get a Hyundai Elantra or a Hyundai Accent that gets over 40 miles per gallon. And you can get the Chevy Cruze Eco that gets 40 miles per gallon. So again, it's about seeking out these cars. Now, just a note, you know, for main drivers, most of these cars are coming with low rolling resistance tires because that improves fuel economy. Those tires are terrible in the snow. So
raises the question, snow tires versus all-season tires.
Get snow tires if you live in Maine.
Just switch them out in the spring.
Just switch them out. And just know that, you know, you will give up in mileage, but you will gain in peace of mind and safety. So just switch them out and get your good mileage in the summer.
Great. Thank you for your call. Let's go to Carol in Gorham. Carol, thank you for being patient. You have a question for Jamie.
Yes, hi, thanks. This is a great show.
Thank you.
Just a quick aside, we own a Prius 06, 115,000, love the car, can't wait for the station wagon to come out. But I'm going to the extreme now. I have to ask you about trucks. My husband and I are thinking about buying a truck that will haul possibly a fifth wheel at some point. And we've never had a truck, and there's so much unreliability on some of them that I just wondered what your best best truck recommendation might be for reliability, repair, and longevity.
Well, Carol, thanks for your question. What did the ranking say about that?
That's a great question. And what you're talking about, if you really want to do a fifth wheel, you're talking about you're going to need a heavy-duty truck. So forget gas mileage. That's going out the window. But in terms of reliability and things like that, all the heavy-duty trucks that are sold in the U.S. are made by American companies. American companies have a huge PR problem when it comes to reliability. That said, it's a PR problem. You can get a fine Chevy truck or heavy-duty truck. You can get a fine GMC heavy-duty truck, and you can get a fine Ford heavy-duty truck. The Ford heavy-duty trucks are some of the best sellers. They're easy to take care of. Any Ford dealership could take care of it. You can get a diesel engine, and they're really much better than they used to be, you know, if you're looking to buy new. I would also, you know, you mentioned that you haven't owned a truck before. I don't know what you're towing the fifth wheel for, whether it's, you know, whether it's horses or something else, but I would talk to people who are involved in the activity that you're looking at the fifth wheel for, you know, maybe other people who are RV or other people who have horses and do a lot of towing, and see what trucks they like and see what features they're looking for. Just because you haven't owned a truck before. And when you're talking about towing, it gets a little bit complicated. Mm-hmm. And so I think talking to people who have actually been there is really your best bet. And talk to them before you go to the dealership so you can go in there with as much knowledge and as much real-world experience as possible. I'd also recommend if somebody will let you take their truck while hitched up to their RV or their trailer out so you can make sure that you like it, take them up on it, because that is the best way to find out what you really like in a truck.
Does that answer it for you, Carol?
That's great. Thanks a lot.
Super. Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Sheila now in Portland. Sheila, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, a short time ago, I was driving a 2007 Prius, and I was rear-ended. I was driving slow, but the car that rear-ended me was driving pretty fast. And my head went slamming into the steering wheel, my face. And I had a lot of facial injuries. And so many people have said to me, why didn't your seatbelt hold you in place?
Any thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I'm terribly sorry that you had to go through that. That just sounds terrible. And I will say, your seatbelt should have held you in place. That should have locked you in place once it felt the impact. I've been in cars, you know, where I've spun out, and even though I haven't hit anything yet, the seatbelts automatically tension up.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know exactly why your seatbelt didn't do that.
Okay.
But what I would do is I would, if I were you, I would go over, if you go to safercar.gov, that's the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration's website, you can go and you can see, you can search by model year and component to see if there are any other issues that were reported with seatbelts in the 2007 Prius, and you can actually report your issue. And if enough people report an issue, then NHTSA is going to open an investigation. And so what you can get from this is you may have had a terrible experience with it, but what ends up happening is you can help prevent someone else from having that experience, which I think would hopefully, you know, get something a little bit of good out of it. And I'm terribly sorry that happened to you. There's nothing worse than being in a car accident.
Sheila, okay,
can you give me the website one more time?
Sure. It's safercar.gov.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Sheila. Time for just one quick email from Erin, who says she's looking to buy a new car within the next couple of years. I personally, I'm always thinking about the next car, although I'll never buy it. She wants to know, when should she really start looking and test driving? What do you,
Erin? I would start looking now. and actually, you know, you're in a good position because the New England International Auto Show, which is in Boston, is this January. I believe it's the week of January 12th. It costs you $12 to get in. And why it's a great thing to look at when you're really beginning your car search is you can go and you can mess. You can't drive the cars, but you can go and you can sit in them and play with all the features and see what they offer and check out the prices without dealers and salespeople talking to you, which for when you're first starting out really helps you get your head around what you like, what you don't like. And from there, then you can start deciding on test drives.
Jamie Page Deaton, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much. This was great.
Jamie Page Deaton is editor of U.S. News and World Report's Best Car Rankings. You can listen to this program and other of our new programs by visiting mpbn.net. Click on the radio tab, then click on call-in program. Today's program was produced by Keith Shortle. John Keimel ran the board and answered your calls. We also had help from Rich Tozier and the MPBN web team. I'm Jonathan Smith. Thank you for listening.